afternoon, the House Committee on Education for Monday, May 16th is called to order. Welcome all. Our agenda schedule and will be first up Senate Bill 193, second up House Bill 3222. Gentlemen, representatives, if you don't mind, just a short interim before we get to you, but we'll respect and honor your time. Senate Bill number 3 would be Senate Bill 882. Thank you, Kelly. Senate Bill, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 193. Mr. Keller, will you please give us an overview?
Senate Bill 193 exempts persons licensed by the Oregon State Veterinary Medical Examining Board who have graduated from certain veterinary colleges or veterinary departments of universities or colleges from regulation by Oregon Student Assistance Commission. There are no amendments and there is no subsequent referral.
Okay, we have... Alan Contreras and Lori McKinnon, please. Or would you, Lori, would you prefer to wait for the next panel? It's your call.
This is fine.
Okay, thank you. Whenever you're ready, please be sure to give us your name for the record.
Okay. Good morning. For the record, my name is Lori Makinen. I'm director of the Veterinary Medical Examining Board. The bill you have before you basically exempts the Veterinary Examining Board from the provisions of the Office of Degree Authorization. We are requesting this exemption because we feel that the Veterinary Board, as most veterinary boards across the country, does an adequate job of ensuring that the schools that we license graduates from are legitimate and valid. And we have been doing this since 1914. We don't see any reason to change it now. The specific issue that brings this to the front was an ODA decision, ODA being Office of Degree Authorization, ODA decision that one of the schools that is located on St. Kitts is illegal for licensing in Oregon. And understanding that ODA statute limits it to looking at merely the country's educational oversight rather than the specific school, we felt that we needed this legislation. Ross University is it's a U.S.-owned school. It's a good school. The fact that it's located on St. Kitts is irrelevant for our purposes. Additionally, we have about 25 Ross grads currently practicing in the state. The consequences of having to tell these practicing veterinarians that they would have to give up their licenses and no longer practice is something I don't want to contemplate. If you have questions about our process, I can go into that. It would take not very long, but basically, we feel that we're doing an adequate job of ensuring that veterinary licensees in Oregon are legitimate.
Thank you, Ms. Makinen. Perhaps we'll hear from our next panelist and ask questions at the end.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Alan Contreras from the Office of Degree Authorization. We have no objection to this bill, but since it discusses what our authority is, I thought we'd better come and say something about it. The letter that I've handed out to you, unfortunately, is the one that I handed out at the Senate committee and has their name on it because our computer system went down this morning and I couldn't make a new one with your folks' name on it. Lori's described the situation accurately. We discovered this problem maybe a year and a half ago or so. We have no interest in pursuing the graduates of that particular school. At the same time, we want to preserve the current ODA statute the way it is to deal with the many diploma mill operations that do operate off the island of St. Kitts. And I really don't have anything else to say, but I'd be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Are there questions for either Mr. Contreras or Ms. Makinen? Representative Roblin?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. So what you're saying is that the way the bill is now constructed is fine. You want to continue to have your organization deal with licenses. This particular case is not a problem, veterinarians.
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, that's correct. The current wording of this bill fixes the unique problem with the veterinary situation, but allows us to continue working with those other state licensing boards, such as TSPC and the Board of Nursing, that actually do prefer that we play a role in this process.
Okay.
Further questions? Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Mackinnon, we have not had any complaints about the 25 Ross graduates that are as to their competency as compared to other veterinarians.
Madam Chair, Representative March, we don't have complaints against Ross graduates that are significantly different from complaints against graduates of Tufts or OSU or anything else.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, I think we really need an exploratory trip, and we should go to St. Kitts and review this.
We're not in work session, but I second that motion. That's a good idea. Mm-hmm. Very good idea.
That's a good idea.
And we don't even need a minority report on that one. Further questions for the panel?
Unanimous.
Thank you very much. Dr. John Betts and Marcia Keith.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Marcia Keith, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. That's the professional association as opposed to the examining board, which you just heard. We are here in support of Senate Bill 193. The bill raises an important policy question as to which state agency is the most appropriate to decide who should be practicing veterinary medicine. And it's our firm belief that in the state of Oregon, it should be the Oregon Veterinary Medical Examining Board. I have submitted some written testimony that goes into some detail about what the steps are for a licensee from a foreign veterinary school to go through in order to become licensed in the state of Oregon, and I won't go through that in any detail with you, but I just think that it's important that the state of Oregon recognize and uphold the veterinary board's authority to approve who practices veterinary medicine. And in closing, I'd just like to give you an example of why this bill is important. This occurred actually in between the Senate hearing on the bill and today. Our executive director of the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association received an email from a veterinary graduate from Ross University who recently had been in the state of Oregon interviewing for a position here. And during her trip, she'd been told by a veterinarian, a practitioner in the state of Oregon, about the issue raised by the Office of Degree Authorization and that the state has potentially questioned the validity of her veterinary degree because she earned it from a non-accredited offshore school. So here's someone who's qualified to treat and care for animals and a doctor who met all of the requirements and a young woman who wants to move to our state and become a productive taxpaying member of the state, and yet there's a conflict in current law about whether her degree is valid, and this bill certainly clears that up. So as in support of the Oregon Veterinary Medical Examining Board, the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association would like to ask you to support this bill. Thanks.
Thank you. Dr. Betts?
Chairman Flores. I'm John Betts. I'm a chairman of the Veterinary Medical Examining Board, and I really don't have anything to add except to say that, well, I feel that as an exam board for the state of Oregon that we do a good job and an adequate job in policing our licensees, and it's up to us to be able to pick these schools and decide whether their programs are adequate and whether the licensees should be eligible to practice in the state. And I would be happy to escort Representative March to say Kitts as an expert witness or an expert guide.
No, you're stuck with the whole panel.
That's all. That's all I have to add.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions for either of our panelists? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I do not have anyone further to signed up to testify in Senate Bill 193. Is there anyone else? We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 193. Senator Mark? Open a work session on Senate Bill 193.
Chair Flores, I would move Senate Bill 193 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative March has moved Senate Bill 193 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Who makes the reservations and when do we leave?
Yeah. I think it's Mr. Keller's job to do that.
Okay. We should say, by the way, committee members and staff, so that will facilitate that we get really good.
Madam Chair.
Oh, this is all a joke. Ethics Commission. Representative Park.
Oh, I just wondered if we were also using Mr. Keller's credit card.
Then we could do it.
I borrow Kelly's.
Oops, I think we're in trouble, huh? Okay. Any further discussion? All of those of the opinion that Senate Bill 193 should move to the floor with a due pass recommendation will vote aye. All those opposed will vote no. The clerk will please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Having received the required majority, Senate Bill 193 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We'll close the work session.
Carrier.
And the carrier. Representative Shields? We will... Can you go to... House Bill 3222. Mr. Keller, if you would give us an overview, please.
House Bill 3222 suspends for the 2005-2007 biennium requirements placed on school districts related to district improvement plans, assessments, alternative placements for students, certificate of initial mastery, certificate of advanced mastery, alternative certificates, alcohol and drug abuse prevention programs, instructional materials, substitute teacher salaries, talented and gifted students, instructional time, class sizes, media programs, and guidance and counseling programs. Prohibits superintendent of public instruction from issuing school district and school performance reports. Prohibits Department of Education from withholding state school fund monies from school districts for not complying with suspended requirements. Prohibits Teacher Standards and Practice Commission from requiring school districts to forfeit state school fund monies while employing persons not properly licensed. Declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2005. It does not have a subsequent referral.
Thank you very much. Representative Boakley and Olson, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I am Brian Boakris. I represent the 23rd House District. And if you'll indulge me, Madam Chair, I'll explain the background of this bill and its concepts. And then after I've got done meandering along and reeling in the visual of Dr. Shields going to the Caribbean, I'll let my good colleague, Representative Olson, give you the details. Madam Chair, this bill came about actually from three or four meetings that Representative Olson and I happened to attend in our county educational forums. Several of our counties have got forums that they get together on either monthly or quarterly basis, and all the school districts come together at that time. And they're the school board members and the superintendents, and I believe Representative Dellum has probably participated in the one in Linn County and some of those areas down there. Starting back in December in the series of meetings, the very first thing that comes up is all the superintendent school boards are asking, well, how much is the budget going to be? And since neither Representative Olson or I served on Ways and Means or the Budget Committee, it was the deer in the headlight look many times. So we said, what else can we do to help you in this? And we consistently have heard over the last, frankly, two bienniums, the issue of, well, there's all these unfunded mandates. And so we asked them at these meetings, said, well, can you address specifically which unfunded mandates that you would like to eliminate from the Chapter 22. And there were bipartisan, there were other representatives, I won't mention other from the other party, there were Democrats and Republican representatives and senators at all these meetings. And we kind of came to the conclusion amongst ourselves that, well, maybe our discussion about eliminating isn't appropriate. That's a policy issue that needs to be studied, so on and so forth. And what we were addressing was, frankly, revenue shortfalls. If your district couldn't afford to do something,
what would you ask us to suspend so you could afford to focus your dollars in the classroom? And that's how it started out. And interesting enough, in the very first, during the month of December, there were about 8 and 13 school districts that we spoke to, and they gave us a list of the Chapter 22, and it's condensed down. What you have in front of you is completely condensed down. They gave us a list of the Chapter 22 mandates. We then went on and went from Benton County and did Linn County, and then I circulated it amongst my own districts. And what we simply ask is if we could suspend or place a moratorium, if you did not have adequate funding, what items, again, would you ask us to suspend for 2 years? It ended up circulating to 68 school districts. We had a long consolidated list, and we sent that back out via a whole series of representatives and said, okay, we need to at least have some sort of agreement of which are the important ones. And we actually boiled it down to about 25. And mind you, I'm not the expert on this. All of this information came from school districts themselves. Then what we said, and what is not in the bill, and you don't see here, we took those 25, we went to Legislative Council, and of course they summarized all of them there, and you ended up with, I think, instead of 25, 18 sections. What we knew at that time is that many of these items would need to be debated by the policy committee, your committee, on which was valid, which might be not valid, so on and so forth. Because what is missing is in this particular bill was the mechanism. The mechanism that we told the districts was this. We said, if your district, if this bill were passed and your district could not, for financial reasons, under the determination of the board, implement one of these programs and you wanted a waiver, then your school board would need to pass a motion in its committee as a public law or a public meeting notice, and then send that notice to the state so that you were notifying the state superintendent that due to fiscal constraints you couldn't comply with this and therefore you'd be eligible. Again, purely a 2-year basis, a moratorium. That came about, and that whole mechanism came about because some school districts said, well, we don't want to eliminate it, we'll eliminate it now. And other school districts, frankly, said, well, we really need to sit down and talk about this. And I know your committee has addressed, you know, interim planning issues, how do you go about this? And what Representative Olson and I were doing was purely approaching this from the revenue side, being on the revenue committee like we are, is how do we enhance your operations and how do we get dollars focused into the classroom? And that's how we came about this. If we proceed with this bill, I mean, there are two things that really need to be done. One is you, the policy committee, look at the entire list and determine which would be appropriate and which may be inappropriate or which bills may have already addressed these issues. And the second thing is the implementation clause, because unlike the bill written here, our intent is one of local control. Again, we want the school district to determine that this, we agree, this item, we cannot financially meet it during these constricted times, and we're going to pass a motion and then inform the state. Having said that, Madam Chair, I think Representative Olson will do a better job than I am.
For the record.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of Education. Wow, you guys are pretty lively here. Okay.
Don't you have fun in your committees, Representative Olson?
Judiciary, oh yes, absolutely. Judiciary, we have a lot of fun there. And revenue. It meets about the same time as this right now, so...
You're snoring then? Is that what you're saying?
No. But it is an exercise in trying to exceed boredom, so...
Where
you cannot tell your committee chair that you said
no,
that.
I did not mean that.
Where does your committee go on their field trip? The jail?
Which one?
We're going to St. Kitts. I don't know where you're going.
Wherever that is.
Okay.
It's bound to be warm and tropical.
It is.
I think Kelly has passed a few things out to you already. If you, yes. Not already. I just want to go through a few things there, and then I want to kind of expound a little bit more, too, with you, if I could. But just some different perspective, a little bit of supportive information as well. And the first item that I'd like to start with you from is a letter that's addressed to me from the Albany Chamber of Commerce. It should maybe be the last one in your pile that you have there. But it's from Janet Steele, who's the president of the chamber. Give you just kind of an idea of the support that's obtained, we've received in that area down there between the Albany and Corvallis area. But The second paragraph I'm just going to share with you here. It is our understanding that recently Superintendent Pat Bedore and Assistant Superintendent Steve Kunke have provided you with a list of unfunded mandates under Division 22 that needed to be either eliminated or modified. The Albany Area Chamber supports the GAP's proposal for lifted unfunded mandates under Division 22 as presented. And they're very active in education, K through 12, specifically in the Lynn and Benton County areas for the Greater Albany Public Safety or school district. The next one that I'd like to refer you to deals with a letter. It's dated January 14, 2005, and there's a total off to the side in the upper right-hand corner that shows $1,053,000. That is a response to an email that I sent to the school assistant superintendent, Steve Kunke, in regards to the 8 points that they initially had submitted to Representative Boquist and I back in November and December, what were some concerns that they had of Division 22 mandates that would most definitely have impact on their school district for GAPS. And you can see the response, without going into great detail, the revenue that they felt that they could save as a result of time loss as well as manpower hours and everything was going to be in the neighborhood of about $1 million in a biennium. So I take that as just that as a model and apply it toward, golly, 190 school districts throughout the state. The potential of savings is, and that's exactly where Representative Boquist and I were wanting to go initially at the very beginning, taking a look at what was looking at from funding dollars, you know, going into this biennium and everything. What could we do to help them out? And this was just another piece here. And another part that I would like to share with you comes also January 25th, 2005 is another letter. Addressed to me from the school superintendent, assistant superintendent Steve Kunke. Once again, just want to make mention to you his support for the direction of some different issues on the Division 22 concerns. But the second paragraph, most definitely, I just want to take some time out to read to you again. It's another piece of just supportive data from his perspective as we go toward this bill. As you know, our district has expressed serious concerns about the feasibility of implementing the Certificate of Advanced Mastery, CAM. While the contextual learning experiences envisioned by the designers of CAM have educational merit, we simply don't have the resources needed to make such experiences a reality for all students. As previously stated, we estimate that creating such a program would cost our district more than $500,000 annually, which that in itself would support where he was going with initially from the first letter that I mentioned to you. So that's another piece I'd like to have with you. And then I also received an email, and that's the fourth document that I have for you. It starts out, it's an email, and it starts out with, "Good morning," and it's from Education Specialist Grant Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Education, Jim Skolkoff. The point that I want to make here is it goes down to the second paragraph on this document. And he writes, "On another topic, at yesterday's state board meeting, the state board approved the proficiency requirements for the Certificate of Advanced Mastery, CAM. With this action, the CAM is complete, it is finished, the cake is baked. This has been over a decade-long journey, and we've crossed the finish line." My point being here that I want to share with this is that 10 years for getting to this point has been a long time. I have a school district that is saying that it's going to cost them, and they're not sure, over $500,000 just to try to implement this. Then if you turn over to the second page, first paragraph, purpose of this guide, because this is an overview of what implementation is of CAM and career-related learning standards. There's a portion here at the very first paragraph that says, "The purpose of this guide is to assist teachers and administrators in the implementation of relevant and rigorous collections of evidence for the Certificate of Advanced Mastery, Career-Related Learning Standards, CRLS, and Extended Application Standard." Point being here is that the guide itself, the purpose of this guide, clearly states rigorous collections. Why would you take and impose that kind of effort on your school districts? I can see why the school districts came to both Representative Boquist and I and shared with us several months back now, if we could eliminate or at least put some type of a moratorium to take a look at, see what kind of impact these would be without for 2 years, and then reevaluate. I can see why they wanted to do that with this kind of effort that is being applied toward them right now throughout the school districts. This is a lot of the reason behind why we're going this direction right now. The House bill that you have in front of you with the 17 different points on there, they are a collection of what numerous school districts were concerned with and wanted to see happen as a result of trying to remove or at least put some type of a temporary hold at the discretion of the school districts to look at whether or not there's a need for those things over a two-year period. So that's pretty much what I have at this point and what I wanted to share with you. But my intent with this was to kind of share what the school districts are feeling right now with this and what I really do believe, if this House bill was to be passed, it would be a great tool to relieve a lot of pressures for the school districts out there throughout Oregon.
Representative Dahlin.
Yes, Representative Olson. This turns the process upside down. In the past, didn't a school ask for blessed relief from requirements and was granted permission? Now they simply say we're going to take relief and notify. So it drives this process into the local school. I think it's the biggest change, isn't it?
Chair Flores is Vice Chair Dahlin. I really don't know because I've not done that much study. If you would have asked me a question about law enforcement, something along that line, I might have been able to respond to that a little bit better.
Let me change that from a question to a statement. I believe that's okay. What happens.
Okay.
It tips the process over and drives it into the local school rather into the okay. State House here in Salem.
Representative Oaks.
Madam Chair, may I respond to that?
Sure.
Madam Chair, Representative Dahl, I think that's true, and I think from our perspective, remember, we only talked to 68 of, 198 districts. But if there's 68 districts out there, then it behooves the state government to approach this from the wisest economical and the wisest business position, and that is, if we know that there's 68 of them out there, and of those 68, they all agree in some form or the other, that if we provide them that authority, rather than doing 68 separate requests times 25 administrative rules, times the number of bureaucracy, times the number of money, the cost savings at the state, let alone at the school district, is enormous here. And so what we're trying to do is exactly what you're saying. And again, remember, this is a two-year period, is all we're saying. And I think everybody would agree that we're in fiscally tight times.
Representative Coleman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to say that I appreciate the fact that there are people thinking outside the box with regard to doing some stuff, because I do believe that there is a real issue, and one of the things is that everybody kind of agrees we don't have enough money to do what we're being asked to do, and we put new ones on, it's ridiculous. At least here we're starting to say which ones, and there are some others in 22. You could have taken graduation requirements. You didn't choose those, and I appreciate that. And then there's some here that I may have some disagreements with, but the idea, I think, is saying, maybe for the first time that I've heard it here, is that we can't keep expecting people to do all these things if we're not going to fund it. Is that really what you're saying?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Robum, I think it's exactly what we're saying. And we're saying in a manner that we want to encourage all of the school districts to do everything they can. That's the first point. What we're looking at is saying is those school districts who can't, we need to approach it. And the reason there isn't 55 or 60 items on here is we tried to get a consensus, and we literally took off. If somebody absolutely disagreed, we asked them to either agree, disagree, or be neutral. And if anybody disagreed, we took it off the list. so that we would have some sort of consensus to go forward with. And what we're asking you to do, and we have another document that we'll leave which explains, I saw Representative March, Madam Chair, was going through looking. We have an explanation document that actually went to Legislative Council for each of these, is asking your members, because you've gone through the entire spring and policy discussions, is identify those items that may have merit or may not have merit, and then proceed from there.
Follow up. Yeah. Thank you again. The biggest concern I have, the one I've got to figure out how to get in my head is, as I look at this, is the idea that some school districts choose not to do some of these standards, and they aren't held responsible for it. And those kids are deprived of that part where the neighboring school does the same things, and that student says, that parent says, well, they're providing it over there or not. And we have this mismatch around expectations. So how do we get that so that, you know, some parent doesn't say, hey, the state is now allowing them to provide this education for this child, but not this particular district?
Answer that.
Representative Dahl would like to answer that.
I think you allow open enrollment across the state, and a parent seeks out that school which best meets the needs of their child. It's a simple answer. Yeah.
Madam Chair?
I'd just like to get their answer first.
Yeah, okay, that would be good. That might be a discussion for another day.
Yeah, might be.
Madam Chair and Representative, it's a great question that you asked, because, I mean, that is a concern, and I understand what the Vice Chair is saying, too, as well, you know, for open enrollment. All we can say is that we're in a position here of hearing and listening to what school districts are wanting and needing out there right now, and we're wanting to try to move on behalf of them to make things work better for education for the kids, you know, and also to try to connect something in relationship with what's happening out here in the state and that of here in Salem's. I'm not specifically saying here. I'm talking about the folks over in the Department of Education. It's not any different than when I used to work on the road. I mean, if I were running a state patrol office or something like that, how could I feel what the troopers were feeling out on the road if I'd not engaged and involved myself with what was going on out there? There's not been the engagement, and there has not been the feel from across the street with what's happening with the school districts as well as the schools. And that, this is a mechanism to try to help make that happen.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Rowland, follow up what Representative Olson is saying. What we're doing, and I fully recognize what you're saying, what we're doing is we're empowering the school districts. And we're going back to the school district and say, you know, we trust your judgment to do what is best. Because even in my district, I have five rural counties, so I have Little Falls City, and I have Dallas School District. So I have a whole variety of different types of school districts. But the one thing we did, and it goes back to, is we gave it as much circulation and gave this to everybody that would ask. And mind you, sitting in the room several times when we were discussing this was as many Democrats and Republicans that are sitting right here. It wasn't a political issue. The issue boiled down to a simple thing, is they were all asking us for the same thing. And so it comes down to, if you have, you know, 25% of the districts asking for it, then we must recognize there's a challenge out there. And so I think we're going to have to trust, and what we're asking is to trust the school district. And again, in the implementation language, is encourage them to do everything they possibly can. Because what they're going to do is come back with a motion potentially in their school board and say, due to fiscal constraints, we just can't do this. And I would not envision them saying, we can't do them all. I would envision they're going to be onesies and twosies based on the priority of the local community, based on the priority of the school board, and based on the input from the teachers, the parents, and those people that are working in those schools. And they're going to identify and say, this is the one weak area, or the one area that we can't do this time. We want to fix it. We want to address it 2 years from now. But this is where we can take more funding from this area or more time from this area and help individual students down the classroom level. Because, again, our goal was to get to the classroom level.
Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe I'll combine, I've got like three questions, but I'll combine two of them into one. I mean, first of all, I think the intent of this is to get the $5.4 billion that we want to send for K-12 gets used in the classroom. And the second part of that is, you've talked about procedures that are going to be done by the school boards, but I don't see any requirement in this legislation at all that directs that. There's no provision for the Department of Education to do rules. relating to that, and I don't see any requirement by the school districts to do that. Am I missing it here?
Madam Chair, Representative March, no, you're not missing it. It gets back to what I was mentioning earlier in my testimony, is we sat down to Legislative Council. It didn't exactly come the way we wanted it. But what we did know when it came back was that you're the policy committee. There would be things that you would have already acted upon. And so to go back and start creating all kinds of amendments to the things, we weren't going to do it. And as I mentioned, what does need to be done is the implementation clause, which says, you know, if you're going to have it, as we said, as school districts, it's got to be amended. And I think there may be items in here that, with your expertise, having been through, like us, in revenue, become experts on taxes. I'm not in House budget, so I can't comment on the 5.4 number. So, therefore, you know, looking at your expertise to say, these are the items that we should do, these are the items that we shouldn't do, and then hashing out, and we'd be happy to work with you, the actual implementation instructions. Because the bottom line is, we want to eliminate bureaucracy, so we don't want to create bureaucracy either.
And in regard to that, I think this is directed at Representative Olson because of your particular expertise. You're familiar, of course, with ORS codes starting with 163, which are offenses against persons.
Yeah, personal crimes, yes.
Including rape, murder,
yes.
Et cetera.
Yes.
And by eliminating the requirement to have administrators have licenses or teachers have licenses, which is, in as the way I read it, in Section 11, we couldn't even tell a district that they had a convicted felon we couldn't even say we're stopping the money from going there. So I don't think that's your intent in this.
I'd have to take a look at it. 185 talks about the sexual offender registration notification from what...
And that's in, if you, the teacher standards and practices includes 163-185, 163-235, 163-355, 365, 375, et cetera. All those kinds of pretty heavy-duty categories of crime.
Mm-hmm.
And by waiving the requirement that forfeiting the money, school districts could have somebody with that kind of a background in their school. And I don't think that's your intent.
Chair Flores and Representative March, you know, I do not know. That's something that I most definitely would have to do some serious homework on, you know, to give you a good response on that.
I think there's a quantum leap being made here. When teachers are checked for criminal background, it goes through the Oregon Department of Education, and the criminal check is done there. Licensure, I don't see this dismissing licensure. What it is allowing is flexibility for presently licensed teachers to be able to move them around the curriculum, which is somewhat hard to do right now. But to imply that we would have a sex offender in the classroom is to stir up angst and anxiety that I don't believe would be there.
In response, 343-173 talks about the effect of employing unlicensed teacher or administrator by certain districts. One of the reasons for employing, one of the categories for denying a license are those very crimes.
But let's go back and look at the process. The process is, when a person hires at the school, a criminal history check is done. The only criminal history checks are not, exclusive to licensed staff. All staff, bus drivers, dishwashers, aides, people hired to assist in the classroom, must have a criminal history check. So you may not have the licensure, but you would still have the criminal history check. And we would not have pedophiles and that sort of people in our schools any more than we do now. It just wouldn't happen that way, Representative.
The problem is the language of the bill, and I that's why I'm saying it's one of the things I'm asking them to take a look at. I think the language is overly broad, and we would have to ensure that those kinds of things didn't creep in.
I think those safeguards are in place right now. Very much so.
Would you like to weigh in, Representative Rowland?
I just want to make a response to them because we've actually had some issues. There are licenses that are removed from individuals who have not been convicted of a crime. And there's still ongoing stuff for others. And it could be other kinds of things, from embezzlement to other things that don't, no one files the crime, they never go to court, but TSPC has that information, and they make recommendations to remove licenses much quicker than does the court system at times. And so I think what Representative March is getting at is there are situations, I believe, and I know it's not the intention of this group, because I know them well enough to know that's right. Not the intention. We just have to figure out a language, in my opinion, that makes sure that we look at why they lost their license. Now, on the other hand, the ability to take a really great math teacher who is really also good at science but doesn't have a science certificate and use him to teach science is something which is what our superintendent and I both understand clearly is very frustrating at times in districts, because you have an outstanding teacher who could do it in multiple areas, and we can't currently do that without the risk of losing money. So
right.
I understand, I think, isn't that
correct? And that's the preference I said was the Representative Boquist talked about. Well, this is the bill they handed us, not the
right.
We came to committee with the bill that we had, not the bill we wanted.
Right.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Respond to Representative March. We came to committee with the bill as a menu. That's what we came from. And relying on, because again, obviously, yeah, I have a master's degree. I think I've used it sometime. And my background's not exactly, you know, from the education community. But you being the policy experts could look at it and say these 6, 8, 10, 12 items have merit, and then we can flush those items out so that we can provide the relief to the local school districts.
Representative Clark.
That took a while, but finally. I just wondered, Representative Boquist, you mentioned that you contacted 68 school districts. Did you talk to the superintendent of those school districts, building administrator, school board? Who did you speak to at each of the districts?
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, what we did is we mass emailed out and we called as many districts and provided as much information we can. Our forum was generally the school board members, the principals, or the superintendents. And that was the initial forum that went out. And from there, we gave anything to anybody who would take it and listen and give us input across the board. And we just kept going on in the count as we go up there. I personally believe, because again, you remember, we asked them to respond three ways, positive, negative, or neutral, so that we would come up with something that was beneficial to everybody. And again, as Representative March pointed out, I'm no expert. We are bringing this on behalf of, I'm from my 23rd House District and the five counties I have, and Representative Olson from his district, as a option to the committee to try and come up with some relief.
Madam Chair, one more. Just one last question.
Additional question?
I'm not sure if this is as much of a question. I just wanted to compliment you both on taking the time to look at mandates and the effect it has on school districts. And I think that in looking through this list, there's some mandates that probably aren't necessary, that we should really take a hard look at suspending. But there are some mandates here that maybe individual school districts don't like, but they are in the best interest of the students that they're teaching. And I think that that's something else that we need to look at very closely, because we want to be sure that kids receive the benefits that they're entitled to. And some mandates provide benefits.
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, I would agree 110% with you. I mean, and you're more of the expert. Ask me a tax question a year ago, I wouldn't have a clue. Ask me one now, I'd sleep.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As some of you know, I'm a social worker by trade, and I'm also very interested in pre-K Head Start issues. I was just curious, in your search, did you come across any unfunded mandates in the pre-K or Head Start world that might affect funding?
Madam Chair, Representative Shields, not in the unfunded mandate program, but in visiting my Head Starts and early in those programs in my district. I mean, obviously it's a funding issue, but actually I never had the issue of, you know, of mandates raised.
Okay.
But then again, I can truthfully say I don't think I really went and looked, Madam Chair, Representative Shields.
Thanks.
And I just wanted to put on the record, I never question your expertise or your concern or interest. I just wanted to follow up on your point, you know, pointing out that this wasn't exactly how you had set it up, and
That's all. It was. I do not question your concern, expertise, or otherwise.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm not an expert on education.
Okay. Thank you.
Representatives, I do have a question in regard to the area there that deals with alcohol and drug abuse prevention programs, instructional materials, substitute teacher salaries, talented and gifted students, instructional time, class sizes, media programs, etc. Were you provided with information from your various conversations on how onerous or burdensome any of these individual and respective areas were?
Madam Chair, yes, we were, and I have, did not bring with me but one copy. I gave to your the committee administration a quarter-inch thick packet of explanations of each line item by line item that was provided to us and what was exactly circulated as Representative Farr asked.
Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen. Phyllis Kirkwood, Russell Bonestill, and John Ryan, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Forrest and committee members. I'm Phyllis Kirkwood with Oregon Substitute Teachers Association. And with me are two of our members who will speak after I give our testimony. Many of the standards which are being suspended in this bill are those which assure the quality of education. We're very concerned about quite a few of them and ask that you not lower these. Although the bill allows them to be suspended for the biennium, we are wondering what will happen after that. Especially the drug and alcohol education, we believe, cannot wait for 2 years. Some of these programs, such as Talented and Gifted, have already been folded into the regular classroom teacher's responsibility. And some schools have made different arrangements for counseling and library services. Instructional time and class size are definitely important in the teacher's ability to do a quality job. Some of these mandates, if suspended, will remain the same as they are through the biennium until more monies are available or they are suspended indefinitely. We are particularly concerned about Section 12, the suspension of the substitute teacher minimum salary and minimum half day. There is nothing in this law that says the salary will remain the same and not go down. The substitute teachers of Oregon are very concerned about this, and many more of them would have been here if they didn't have a job today. Please don't allow our salary to be suspended. I'll give you a little history of how the formula was created in the beginning. First of all, ORS 342.610 used to be a minimum for all teachers, but in 1975 it was changed to be just the minimum salary for substitute teachers. Once in a while we hear people saying, well, why don't we let the substitute teachers just be on the market? And that was never true, because otherwise we could get $200 on a Friday preceding the holidays. Rather, when the substitute teacher's salary was just allowed to remain, it would remain the same for decades. And then, with the help of OEA, we would come after the salary had fallen to less than 50% of a regular teacher, and then the legislature would declare an emergency. Finally, in 1975, Representative May Yee designed the formula for tying the substitute teacher minimum as a percentage of the state's average beginning teacher. The Department of Education could use the data from the preceding year in order to be able to announce in the spring what the minimum would be for the coming school year, thus allowing the school districts to set their budgets. But it makes it so the salary is always a year behind the stated percentage. In 1995, we came to the legislature to ask for an increase in the salary for the long-term substitutes. But through various problems, and mostly the opposition of Portland Public Schools, it was decided to give all of the substitute teachers a raise over a period of 4 years. So in 1995, with the sponsorship of Representative Starr, Charles Starr, it was raised to 85%, from 75 to 85%. This formula has been a modest and defensible guideline for districts that did not have a salary tied to their own district's base. Some of the districts at that time went down to pay the minimum, including two of the districts that have substitute teacher unions. So we feel that this has saved, the minimum has saved the state monies. Long-term substitute teacher salary in Portland reverted from scale to a beginning teacher's salary, because now that was all that was required. In Oregon, representatives, substitute teachers hold the same credentials as regular teachers. They do the teaching and evaluate the work of the students for the days that they are in charge, often under difficult circumstances with unfamiliar students. And it requires extraordinary talent in classroom management and discipline. Approximately 1 year out of a student's education is taught by substitutes. In order to renew our credentials, most of the substitute teachers do have regular teaching credentials. The cost is approximately $1,800, and it is not reimbursed by the school district. The substitute minimum includes no consideration for advanced degrees or years of experience. In this law, the average salary for a beginning teacher is divided by 190 to get the daily rate. Yet only 175 days, student contact days, are available to the substitute to work. With two-thirds of the assignments being half days, it is possible for substitutes working 100 full days per year to make approximately $14,000, which, according to the State Department of Education, is below the salary of a high school dropout, and they receive no benefits. We recommend that rather than cutting the rate or allowing the rate to be suspended, that school districts not send teachers out to meetings or cause them to be absent from their classrooms other than for sickness. And that is a better way to reduce the substitute teacher budget. Now, this bill also allows a substitute teacher to be hired for less than half day. We could understand if they were going to be able to prorate after a minimum half day, but we don't like to go to work for less than half day because of the price of gas, the price of the babysitter, and many substitutes cannot live near the school. They have to drive many miles to get to the school. Regular teachers can cover an hour or two, or even the principal could cover for less than half day. Please do not allow the erosion of salary or working hours for Oregon substitute teachers. And Representative Boquist and Representative Olson mentioned getting monies back into the classroom. Well, that's where we are. We are in the classroom. Then I have attached just a list of what the salaries have been for the past few years, the minimum salaries. Thank you very much for listening. If you have questions, I'll try to answer them.
Thank you. How about if we take the other testimony, as you would choose?
Good afternoon, Education Board and Representative Flores, Chair. My name is Russell Bonestill, and I am here on behalf of my fellow substitute teachers. I come with a great deal of concern over the proposed legislation under Section 12 of 3222. We substitute teachers have a great deal of time, effort, and money invested in our educations. We are professionals, and we offer a great variety of services and talent. If this bill passes, we may have a situation that would occur like that which occurs in Arizona and other states wherein substitute teachers come into the classroom. They are neither certified and nor are they professionally prepared, and they are paid a minimum wage. That equates to a situation wherein the children suffer having not a real educator, but something on the lines, an order of a babysitter. Our children in our public schools have suffered already with continuing cuts in classroom time and continuing cuts in programs. And to undermine your substitute teachers throughout the state is to further do a disservice to them. Moreover, I did some basic calculations. I had assumed that it was 177 school day or school year, and with Salem's amount being $148, if I were to teach or if my colleagues were to teach every day in the classroom, that would amount to an amount of around $26,311 gross. And that doesn't even take into account the amount of money that we're paying back for student loans. I'm still in the process of repaying my student loans. We need a working wage. We need a livable wage. The amount of money that the education system stands to save by tanking the substitute teacher pay system is, I believe, marginal compared to other places where it could indeed trim some of the economic fat. For an example, much of the educational costs, as I understand it, come from administrative costs. For an example, I had been a special education teacher. I had been certified and worked as such in that capacity for a time. And it came to my awareness that the average special education teacher spends 60% of their time out of the class taking care of administrative paperwork and going to meetings rather than being in the classroom serving the children who most dearly need that service. Changes in the law would allow for a greater usage and more efficient, effective use of our monies. Moreover, many of the administrators, the top rung administrators, are receiving enormous amounts of money, and frequently, even in times of hardship such as this time, are receiving huge perks and additional raises and this kind of thing. So this is another place where the state and the school districts could seek to maximize their educational dollars. We substitute teachers provide a professional service. We have been trained and we are experienced. I myself, like many of my colleagues, have been in many different educational contexts. I have worked in special ed, mainstream, and alternative classroom settings. I routinely, as a matter of maintaining my license, expend a great deal of money and time to take courses to retain my teaching license and to further my skills. I'm asking that you consider very heavily the cost versus benefit of slashing substitute teacher pay in the state of Oregon. I can virtually guarantee the board here that if you do this, you will see a great exodus of professionals leaving the field, because we simply cannot. We're barely making ends meet under current situation, under the most favorable circumstance, and you will see a mass exodus of professionals if this portion of the bill of 3222 is allowed to stand. I thank you for your time and your attention to my concerns.
Thank you.
And those of my colleagues.
Thank you.
Questions, comments?
We'll take those at the end.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Ryan.
Thank you, Representative Flores. My name is John Ryan. I'm a substitute teacher here in the state. I work mostly in Salem, and I work the alternative programs. I'm also a recent new teacher as of 1986. I decided to become a teacher after many years in blue-collar work, lumber industry out in Dallas, Representative Borquist's area, and am familiar with blue-collar work. In my capacity now as an educator, I frequently receive long-term positions. This year I had a Title I position teaching reading to struggling youth, and have been trained very competently through the great education system here in the state. I believe that if we allow teachers to come in that aren't certified, that aren't competent, it will undermine our educational programs. I'm also concerned with the minimum wage, that we will not be able to make ends meet. I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but as an educator, I cannot receive unemployment benefits during extended layoffs, as they happen every year. In the light of that, it is very difficult for educators to make ends meet during those layoff periods. I'm strongly against House Bill 3222 for these reasons, as well as the other funding cuts to the programs that our students really need in this day and age. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll wind up with Margaret DeLacy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon. For the record, I'm Margaret DeLacy from Portland. I'm appearing here today as a volunteer with the Oregon Association for Talented and Gifted. I'm here to talk about my concerns with House Bill 3222, which, if passed, would suspend major portions of our education law. This is a lot. Okay. There are many programs listed in this bill which you've not received any testimony about, as far as I know, this session. Before suspending them, I think it would be a good idea to hold hearings and to give parents, students, teachers, and other concerned community organizations an opportunity to tell you more about them and why previous legislators thought it was a good idea to include them in our state law. The two representatives who proposed this bill evidently spoke to school superintendents and school administrators, but I didn't hear from them any evidence that they talked about the recipients of school services, the people who don't do the paperwork but actually need these services to continue to be successful in school. And I think in all fairness, they should have an opportunity to tell you why they believe these services are important to them before you suspend them. I'd like to comment specifically on the suspension of the Talented and Gifted program because I know that one best. Last spring, the Oregon Department of Education held statewide sessions on the TAG program. There was widespread participation from across the state. About 250 people attended these sessions in person, and 300 parents, 140 students, and 75 TAG coordinators and teachers completed written surveys for a total of 535 written surveys. These are the people who are consuming these services. You have a copy of the report that the department made in the packets I provided, made on these sessions, as well as articles about those sessions that appeared in both the Eugene Register Guard and the Salem Statesman Journal. These sessions were held by a VTEL hookup, so I attended one session at each site. At each session connected several areas, and I heard all the testimony. I have it here, as a matter of fact, my notes. And last night, I reviewed my 21 pages of notes from all that testimony. The vast majority of parents and teachers said that the TAG program was inadequate and that their children were suffering and their students were suffering as a result. A few spoke about places where it was working well. Over and over again, participants mentioned the lack of appropriate services for students and the need for more funding. Teachers pleaded for more training and better support from the Oregon Department of Education, ODE. Not a single person mentioned any problem with paperwork, excessive reporting, or too much regulation from the state. Not a single one out of hundreds of people said that that was a problem here. Instead, parent after parent, teacher after teacher, principal after principal spoke about the need for more state leadership in this area. I've just given you I'll tell you about the first three, and I've provided some additional examples of what was said on a separate sheet for you. From the South Coast, just when things get going, the rug is pulled away because there's no support from higher up, from high desert. The underfunding of the TAG mandate puts forward the idea that it really doesn't matter. I miss leadership at a state level. It feels like we've gone back to the beginning again. Even some token funding would bring credibility to the program. From Wasco County, TAG seems to be the runt of the litter in terms of getting support. In fact, last night I was thinking I might collect a little collection of similes and metaphors that were used, but they were all similar to that one. I urge you to review the report from the Department of Education and consider the comments that these parents made and also the comments that the department summarized in its report, and ask yourselves how suspending the TAG mandate would address any of the problems that were mentioned in the testimony that was received. This is not what parents, teachers, administrators, and principals across the state are asking you to do to improve instruction. The Oregon TAG mandate passed only because of very strong grassroots support from parents and teachers. Nearly every session since then, there's been an effort by a handful of lobbyists to repeal it, often through backdoor methods. So far, they failed. However, all state funding, TAG funding was cut without any public testimony at the very end of the final session of 2002. The state superintendent has used the loss of that funding, which incidentally has always been earmarked for staff development, teacher training, as an excuse for lack of leadership from the Oregon Department of Education. In the past, the department has shown a much higher level of leadership in this area, and it has made a real difference on the ground. OTAG has worked very closely with the ODE for about 20 years on this, and we've had some real successes. I believe that the department can and should be doing a much better job. The passage of this bill will tell them that they no longer need to bother at all. I believe that if you suspend the TAG mandate, there's a very good chance that we will never get it back. I don't think it's a good idea to make such a serious decision without giving adequate warning and taking further testimony from the people who receive the services and need them badly. By doing this, you'd be sending a message to parents across the country that Oregon is really turning its back on excellence in education. On Thursday afternoon, this past Thursday, a judge of the Multnomah County Circuit Court ruled on a case that has been pending since 1997, when a group of Portland parents, and I was one of them, filed a complaint with the Oregon Department of Education concerning a lack of appropriate instruction for Portland TAG students. After many delays, the department twice found Portland to be out of compliance with the TAG mandate. The third time, they found Portland in compliance, and we exercised our right to appeal that decision. The judge ruled that the Oregon, and this is a quote from the newspaper article I've given to you. It appeared in the Oregonian on Saturday. The Oregon Department of Education must reevaluate whether Portland Public Schools is doing enough for its talented and gifted students, and must consider whether its rules governing TAG programs in all school districts are strong enough. If you pass this bill, you'll overturn that ruling and undermine years of hard work and faith in our system of government. Many Oregon families, and families across the country, I might add, I've gotten email from all over the country, have followed this case very closely. This is no time to send a signal that Oregon is ready to abandon its most capable children. I hope that we'll respect the testimony that has actually been collected from hundreds of parents and teachers across the state and strengthen our TAG programs instead of suspending them. I urge you to send a message to the ODE that you expect them to do more. Thank you very much. I take any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Lacey, and congratulations on the ruling last week. Representative Roll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is a little bit about my frustration. So we as a legislature realize that it costs to have all these mandates, and we put in place the quality education model that said to fund schools this year we'd need $7.1 billion. Realistically, and you look at the money, we don't have $7.1 billion. And so we have these mandates that are out there that require us to do things, and we aren't getting the funding for it. Do you see any, you know, I mean, I think what people came with this was to say, you know, we haven't provided the money, and therefore why do we keep having these mandates? Any answer to that? I mean, we haven't funded this program in particular.
Representative Roblin, I agree with you that this program has not been funded. This program has not been funded in good times and bad, actually.
Okay.
And I have frequently, I can remember when my son started in Portland Public Schools being told there wasn't enough money for him at a point when Portland had so much money they didn't know what to do with it. I think the biggest problem with TAG is ignorance. And not necessarily funds. Funds is used as an excuse for the lack of leadership and the ignorance that we have. In general, I certainly agree with you that education in general in our state is seriously underfunded. But my feeling also is that we need to use the dollars that we have effectively. And teaching students material that they have already learned and know very well is not an effective use of the money we have. And the TAG mandate enables the state to provide some information and leadership to districts to understand, help them understand that.
Further questions for Mr. Lacey? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3222. We will move to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 882. Mr. Keller, please.
Senate Bill 882 directs Employment Department to perform statewide and regional needs assessment for health care occupations to be used by joint boards of education to inform higher education providers and health care industry employers of identified needs. Requires education boards, when approving health care education programs, to use statewide needs assessment for purposes of coordinating programs and facilitating student access to programs. And we do not have, oh, I'm sorry, we do have a, no.
Never mind, back up.
Period. Rescinded.
Okay. I think Senator David Nelson will be coming forward, Molly Moore, and Joe Bell.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Joel Bell, and I'm with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And
very appreciative that you're going to hear our bill today. Senate Bill 882 is sort of broadly addressing the healthcare workforce shortages, and we've been aware of huge healthcare workforce shortages for 5+ years now, and it's an issue that's not going to go away. However, today we are not going to talk about the general overview of the healthcare workforce issues, and if at some time your committee has the time and the interest, we would be happy to do that. But today we really want to focus the limited time that you have on Senate Bill 882. I'm going to address the sort of the needs and the barriers for the bill, and then Molly is going to address the intent behind the bill. One of the needs that we're trying to address with this bill is the fact that here in the state we don't have any specified data for needs assessment that is required to be used. And so while most of the post-secondary educational programs, in fact the community colleges and higher ed, are required to provide needs assessments as parts of their program approval process, there is no established standard format that's being used. And so what happens is that it's generally focused in their areas, particularly when it's community colleges, and there's not a real look at what the statewide needs are around around the state. And beyond development of the data needs, the current program approval process does not address the needs of a particular healthcare profession around the state. And the example that I use a lot is in radiology technology. It is actually, according to our last surveys, got the highest percentage of need. The highest number of need, obviously, is nursing, and I think you're probably all aware of that, but we need radiology technology technicians around the state. And when a program is developed in one locality of the state, there's not really a mechanism or a requirement that the State Board of Education and the State Board of Higher Education look at the entire state need and see about the potential for expanding that program around the state and making sure that it's needed. Another one of our barriers that we're trying to address with this bill, and that also goes into the program approval process, is that it is very expensive to develop healthcare education programs. There are clinical requirements for placement that require some additional time and effort on behalf of the school that's proposing the programs. There are frequently lab requirements. There are student to faculty ratios for a lot of those because of those lab requirements. And so they're very expensive to develop. And again, using the Rad Tech example, community college in Pendleton, Blue Mountain Community College, would probably find it very difficult, well, impossible, to develop a program for Rad Tech because they might only need two or three. So our hope is that we can also share resources around the state and make sure that the education gets delivered where it's needed around the state. And it's sort of a strange conundrum because at the same time that we are wanting programs to be available around the state and to conserve resources and make sure that we are expanding programs, there are areas where programs have been duplicated. And then what happens is that this area of the state has a program in respiratory therapy, and this one has a program in respiratory therapy, and they're able to maintain them for a short period of time. And then because they don't have the quantity of students to maintain the program, one or the other goes away. So the program that we have lost, that institution and the local healthcare providers who are part of their basis for developing program needs, have spent a great deal of time and energy and money, resources, both state and private, in order to develop the program. So we have this kind of conundrum of sometimes we have too much and sometimes we don't have enough. And so that's one of the issues that we're trying to address here. And further, one of the things that happened last session, and Senator Nelson will probably address this, was a bill called House Bill 2577, and he and then Representative Lori Mona Sanderson, now Senator Mona Sanderson, were the sponsors of it. And it's really focused on using distance and other technology to expand the health care programs, and we really think that's a need that we need to really focus on, and part of this bill will help in the approval process, will help that too, where we can start looking at other alternative ways to deliver the programs around the state. And then the final piece, the final issue is that we have students who are particularly in the nursing field, who are taking between 4 and 7 additional courses. An example would be anatomy and physiology, because they are trying to prepare to be able to apply to a variety of the nursing programs around the state. And one of the things that this that we're trying to address here too is transferability and mobility of students from one program to the other. I should also mention that while the language that we have in this bill is similar to language that is already going to be in another bill that's broader, and that is Senate Bill 342, which the community colleges and higher ed institutions have worked on to direct them to look at these issues broadly across education. So now I will turn it over probably to Senator Nelson. Thank you.
Welcome, Senator Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Chair. My name is David Nelson, State Senator from District 29. It's 4 counties, Umatilla, Union, Mallow, and Morrow counties. I'm a co-sponsor along this bill, along with Senator Mona Sanderson, and she can't be here. She's on a field trip today, so she's not here today. Some of the history, these folks will give you the details of what the bill's on, but the history of this bill goes back actually quite a ways. It goes back to the 1999 session. We weren't thinking about it at that particular time, but we did the telecommunications bill 622. You'll find a lot of those people that were involved in that particular endeavor, in which you have the success stories with Google and with Yahoo. They're now coming into our state because of the fact we have this statewide infrastructure. It's like Olympic bands that are hooked together, and there's 5 of them, and they're redundant and high speed and high bandwidth and things like that. So it seems like every session we come along, there's been a bill or some sort of movement to take advantage of that. In the 2001 session was Oregon Opportunity, where we did things with Oregon Health Science University. In the last session, as Joe was talking about, we did House Bill 2577, which basically set forth a policy of technology for the state of Oregon, increase access to all of our citizens. And then in the interim, in the last session, there was a group of folks, the Oregon Telecommunication Coordinating Council, which was started by House Bill 2577, got a group of healthcare providers together with the Governor's Commission on Health and a few other folks and Oregon Health Science University, and so they said, okay, you've got all these silos for giving healthcare access. How do you put those things all together with education? And so they've come to an agreement. They're going to do that. So this bill is kind of a one for the step, but it's talking about workforce rather than health care and getting the employment department involved in it. So, one, there's a history behind all this, too. There's a group of people that have really quite an effective networking, people at the community level, and they're from throughout the state, urban, rural, and they're trying to create this access. We have a Senate bill that you'll probably be hearing at some point in time. Well, it's probably in the Representative Brown's committee on Senate Bill 15 to extend the life of Oregon Telecommunications Council. I hope you'll look very closely at that, because they're not paid. They do all this volunteer work. They would like to be paid, but there's no money to do that. But they're going to stay together to take care of business. And these bills that I see in the Senate Bill 882 is an outgrowth of a lot of that work that's been done, where people are seeing a need, and then they move forward and say, okay, let's take care of business. It's a very, very active, energetic group, and they're doing a lot of good things for the state of Oregon. And I know Molly's gotten involved from the governor's viewpoint. Before that, it was Diane Vines, wasn't it? That was one of the forces behind it. And so you know, it's just not, this thing just isn't coming out of left field. This is kind of a accumulation, and it seems like every session something like this comes up and say, hey, this is a good idea, let's go do it. So I'll let these folks talk about all the all the good parts of it, but that's my perspective of where I'm coming from, and I certainly hope you can see your way to support this bill.
Thank you, Senator Nielsen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to sit here before you today and support Senate Bill 882. For the record, I'm Molly Moore with the Governor's Office, Healthcare Workforce Initiatives Coordinator, a lofty title, but in any event, I'll be very brief because I think Joe Bell and Senator Nielsen did a really good job of explaining the issues around this bill and why it's important. Briefly, there are three main sections to this bill. Number one, it directs the Oregon Employment Department to work with industry and educational institutions to perform regional needs assessment for healthcare workforce and to help provide a set of standardized data in terms of determining where and when to invest in healthcare education programs. It directs the state, number two, directs the state boards of education to utilize this data to identify and direct the development of statewide healthcare education programs by community colleges, state university, and Oregon Health and Science University. And thirdly, the bill states that all new healthcare education programs must assure statewide access, student transferability between programs, course articulation, and common student learning outcomes for healthcare education programs. So why is this important? Overall, this goal is to help expedite students through the system and thus reduce healthcare costs overall. We hope to promote the development of healthcare education programs when and where they're needed and help us better understand where the resources are needed so we can invest our dollars in the most important places, essentially. Additionally, as with regards to this bill supporting the development of these programs, they help to utilize shared curriculum, as I mentioned, sharing faculty expertise, which will make the most efficient use of students' time and resources. I know you all have heard the stories of students taking additional courses in order to qualify for multiple programs across the state, and this bill helps to alleviate that need. And overall, this bill just helps us to provide the right number of healthcare workforce at the right place, with the right education at the right time. It aligns with the governor's overall goal of linking education and workforce development, and he fully supports this bill. In addition, when we testified to on the Senate side, Graham Slater from the Oregon Employment Department testified with us, and he's unable to be here today. However, I provided written testimony for you, and basically the testimony indicates that the Oregon Employment Department is standing ready and willing and able to perform the duties required by this bill. And finally, I'd just like to state that this bill passed unanimously in the Senate, and so we think it's a good bill to support. And Chair Flores, members of the committee, that is my testimony on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for the panel? We have an A+.
Thank you.
Julie Sahanek, please.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Julie Sahanek. I'm with the Oregon Community College Association, and we just wanted to get on the record that we support Senate Bill 882 as amended.
Short and
job. Any questions for her?
No.
Yeah. Representative Dolan would like to query you, Ms. Sahanek.
Why?
Why not?
Are you serious?
No, Julie. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 882. We will open a work session on Senate Bill 882.
Madam Chair, I move that we move Senate Bill 882 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dolan has moved Senate Bill 882 to the House with a due pass recommendation. Discussion, please. Well, we are just a quiet group and want to get out of here. I can just absolutely hear this one coming. We do recognize the merit of the bill and the importance in the healthcare industry, and I'm sure we'll debate that further on the floor. So
those of the opinion that Senate Bill 882 should be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation will signify by saying aye. Those opposed will say no. The clerk will please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Having received the required majority, Senate Bill 882 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Flores will be the carrier. We will close the work session on Senate Bill 882. Seeing nothing further to come before this committee, we'll see you in a half hour on the floor. We are adjourned.
Back on the floor.